where does the modern regulatory state in Britain come from? Mm. And oddly, I think it's largely a creation of the Thatcher government. But in the US, the administrative state, as it's often called there, it was an intentional project of the progressives, I think from the 1920s onward, to create this new kind of elite government of experts and executive agencies and everything. And you kind of wonder whether the incredible advances of the Industrial Revolution could possibly have happened with modern attitudes towards risk.
The government has announced a 10-point plan to slash red tape. This includes ensuring all new regulations are, quote, absolutely necessary, and imposing even stronger growth duties on regulators. There's also specific changes coming for medium-sized businesses. More alfresco dining is also on the way. But is the government going anywhere near far enough to reduce the regulatory burden? Welcome back to the IA Podcast. My name is Matthew Lash, and I'm the IA's Director of Public Policy and Communications. Each week, this podcast asks a tantalizing policy question. Today's question, is the government finally deregulating? To discuss, I'm very excited to be joined by the IA's very own Tom Cockerty. He's our executive director. He's also the author of a recent report for the Centre for Policy Studies called The Future of Regulation. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
I'm wondering what you make in broad terms of the government's announcement this week. So they put out a white paper, which outlined a bunch of new regulatory principles, and then there were some more specific changes that were announced, one of which they claim could save £150 million every year.
Mm. Well, look, I mean, we spend most of our time here criticising this government, all governments, for the things they get wrong. Yeah. It's worth giving credit where credit is due and when they do something good saying so. And I think that the measures that they came out with this week, the updates to the better regulation framework, some of the specific deregulatory measures that they've hinted at, they're all good. They all go in the right direction. They're very welcome. And I think it would be churlish of me to be hypercritical when actually they've picked up, in some form at least, a few of the proposals that we made in that Centre for Policy Studies report. So it's a thumbs up, right? But does it go far enough? That was the question. And I think clearly it doesn't. These are all good things, but they're good things at the margin. They're improvements, sure, but do they fundamentally change the state of regulation or the burdens on business or the infringements on individual freedom in this country? No, probably not. And I think one of the interesting things, if you look at the broad sweep of better regulation efforts, and we've had a better regulation effort almost as long as we've had modern regulation. I mean, this is not confined to Conservative governments. Even under Tony Blair, there was a better regulation executive or something. I can't remember the precise name. Working on precisely these things. So it's a constant effort. And I think what that tells you is that to a certain extent, you have to run to stand still. One part of government is always regulating. Another part of government is always trying to make regulation better or to hold back the tide of regulation. And so we sort of oscillate around a midpoint. And sometimes it gets better, sometimes it gets worse, but we're not really changing the overall game. And I think the proposals we've seen from the government this week, as welcome as they are, and as much as I would commend them, it doesn't change that fundamental picture.
I mean, it seems like there's almost something wrong here in the phrasing or the framing here, which is when you start talking about better regulation, you're accepting the premise that there exists a kind of ideal state of regulation. All you need to do is kind of change the dials a little bit in order to improve outcomes, and everything will be grand and great. And there's a lot of rhetoric, including in the government's white paper this week, about, you know, the value and importance of regulation for the environment, for workers' rights, for the water industry, for energy. You know, you can go on and on here where there are, you know, heavily regulated sectors of the economy. I suppose the critic might then say, well, it's all well and good to talk about how there's too much regulation, but don't we need some level of regulation? Don't we need to ensure that water companies aren't dumping sewage into our rivers? Don't we need workers' rights to ensure that they're not exploited by their employer?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no, you know, even going straight from the examples that you gave there. So I think that there's an interesting historical angle to this, right? Where does the modern regulatory state in Britain come from? Mm. And oddly, I think it's largely a creation of the Thatcher government. Now, that sounds strange. Of course, we've had regulation going back hundreds of years of various varieties. But the kind of modern economic regulation, which then branched out into environmental and social and everything else, that really started with the modernization of the state and the wave of privatizations that you had in the Thatcher years. And so the idea was you had state-owned companies or state-owned industries, and you privatized them. You were trying to introduce competition, but because these were either natural monopolies or they were artificial monopolies, but that had just been established and state-backed for so many years, you needed regulation to protect the consumers and protect everyone else involved. And now, of course, the goal, the remit of that original generation of economic regulators was basically to create competitive markets and slowly make themselves redundant. So the idea was you would get to a point where markets were competitive enough that competitive pressures were the main regulator. And if there was a role for government, it would be a small residual one. And that actually points, I think, to the key to this whole debate about regulation, which is that markets are, to a great extent, self-regulating if they're competitive, if they're working properly. And regulation provided by government, as opposed to self-regulation or whatever, should be a last resort. So it should be a response to a clearly defined market failure where you say, look, this market isn't sufficiently competitive, or the information asymmetries are so big in this particular market, or the externalities are so great that you need the government to step in. But at least in terms of economic theory, the role for government regulation should be very small and very targeted. But I think what we've seen over the years is you've started off with that economist's perception of regulation, and gradually just all sorts of other duties and obligations have been layered on top of it. So that you actually get this sort of massively expanding, ever-growing, complex web of regulations that no one would have really intended at the outset. No one really understands in the present. But equally, our institutions of government and policymaking, and even outside groups who try and study policy and make recommendations, we're just ill-equipped to deal with. People talk about the blob a lot. And then that's sort of a pejorative way to talk about, I don't know, the civil service and the third sector and everything. But in a very meaningful way, regulation does operate as a blob, which is to say it's there, it's big, it's expanding, but it's not really under any clear sort of direction. It just tends to grow.
It kind of has its own logics to it, I guess, as kind of positive feedback loops. So
yeah.
Once you create a regulator, that regulator will often face pressures either from parliamentarians or sometimes from industry that wants to see regulation that might be in their benefit, or from third-party groups to then keep exercising more and more power in different ways, either using their existing powers or often being given new powers, and then they're just going to keep going down the line. And that's a very interesting point you started with there, though, which is that the unintended consequence of Thatcherism was the regulatory state. So you went, I think there's some literature that talks about the move from the positivist state, where the state owns things, to the regulatory state, where the state directs things. And it kind of says that from almost a political economy perspective is, and from a politician perspective, is actually much better. At least you would think it would be in the short run, which is to say politicians, outsource blame, let's give one example, to the water companies, and then they have all the kind of power through regulation. I don't know if that's necessarily worked for politicians. I think they are being blamed for things like the issues in the water industry, even if some of those issues are exaggerated. They are still in some ways responsible for all the regulators and the regulatory actions, even though they don't necessarily have much direct control over it. But I also suspect there's another issue here, which is because it is so amorphous, it is so big, it's even if they wanted control of it, they couldn't. The reason why you have all these regulators is because we expect the state to do so much.
Yeah.
Because we expect it to intervene in so many markets, and that you need some level of expertise, but you just need more people, more things going on. And the more people and more things going on, the more it becomes disconnected from any kind of political control, except for when something goes wrong and everyone goes, oh my goodness, why wasn't the minister paying attention to what was going on here?
It's striking. And it was one of the things that occurred to me when I was doing that CPS research. And actually, that CPS research took place over quite a long period of time. It was one of those things started before the pandemic, put it aside to work on other things, then came back to later. And so it was, these ideas were rolling around in my head for a long time. And one of the frustrations actually was, if you want to write about the British regulatory state, you don't have, I think, an awful lot of literature and research to draw upon. Admittedly, you have a lot about the privatized utilities. Now, that's been studied a lot, and competition law as well. So certain aspects of regulation are well studied. But the sort of broader category of just regulation as a whole, or the regulatory state, and what it is, what it consists of, how it operates, what its impact is. That's something that isn't really looked at. You can find a few articles here and there, but it's thoroughly understudied, in my opinion. And I think you can compare that with the US. Now, the US has had, we may have ended up in roughly the same sort of situation, although our regulatory states are different in meaningful ways. But in the US, the administrative state, as it's often called there, it was an intentional project of the progressives, I think from the 1920s onward, to create this new kind of elite government of experts and executive agencies and everything. And because it was intentional and because it was clear what the plan was to a certain extent, it's something that's been studied by economists and lawyers, and there's a sort of robust literature about it, and there are different schools of thought that you can draw on when you look at these questions. We don't have that in the UK, and I think perhaps the reason is that we've stumbled into our regulatory state as it exists today basically by accident. This is a classic British way of doing policy, right?
Muddling through.
It's muddling through writ large. So we wanted to privatise things. And kind of as an accidental consequence, we ended up doing this incredible modernisation of the way we approached regulation. One of the books I read, I think it was called about the British regulatory state by a guy called Michael Moran, who was one of the only academics I could find who studied the British regulatory state. And he talks about the transition from kind of club government, which is what you'd had from sort of from the Victorian era through to the 1970s. It was kind of the old boy network, and it was government inspectors and self-regulation and, you know, industry bodies looking after themselves. And so then we created this new modern kind of regulatory state, but without maybe really thinking through what its implications were or where it would go in future. And then successive governments, again, I think without a clear plan, have just thought, well, we've got these regulatory bodies, we have these policy objectives. It would be kind of inconvenient for us to tax to raise the money and then spend it dealing with this problem, whatever that problem is. Let's say it's low wages. The minimum wage is a classic regulation. Now, if you're worried about people not having enough money, of course, you could tax and you could spend to give them welfare benefits to top up their income. Or you could just say to businesses, we're going to raise the minimum wage and you're going to have to pay it, shift the cost that way. To government, this seems like the easy option, the costless option. That's one example, but across the whole range of...
Classic example of the wage, it does have costs, right?
It does have costs.
Every regulation has costs. Minimum wage classically being reduced hours and potential unemployment, disemployment impacts for young, unskilled, etc.
But if you're a policymaker, those costs are not as obvious and they're borne by other people. They're dispersed, exactly. Whereas if you have to tax, people will notice, people won't like that. And if you spend money, that attracts a lot of attention as well. But so I think the broader point here is that basically you've had a succession of sort of social issues or environmental issues where governments have wanted to do something. Something must be done. What are you going to do? You're not going to tax and spend. You're going to regulate. And you've got this growing regulatory state there, and you've got bodies who can seemingly put your will into action. It's too easy. It's too easy as a policymaker to say, here's a problem, here's a regulatory solution, Mr. Regulator, do this. And you just don't think it through. And you develop something which was never intended. And I think that's where we are with our regulatory state.
I find it's you make this point as well in the report you did recently, that you can contrast this quite clearly with the way the fiscal side of government works. If a department wants to spend something, there's an extensive review process. They have to effectively get permission from the Treasury. People say Treasury has too much power in that process. But that is designed very much to ensure that public spending is very, well controlled. Maybe we would say it's not anywhere near well enough controlled. But if you're a minister and you want to propose a new bit of spending, it is genuinely quite difficult. There is something you have to go through. If you want to propose a new regulation, now yes, there's some processes you have to go through to make an impact assessment, although if you spend some time reading those, as indeed you have, you find that they're largely garbage. But as you say, because the costs are not borne by the government, they're not borne fiscally, there's no big incentive not to do it. Another thought, though, that also comes there is just the fact that because of the way the regulatory state developed, it's very hard, even just as researchers, to get an idea of, or indeed as someone who is expected to follow the regulation, like get an idea of all the potential regulations that could impact you and your industry. Something I saw the government has announced, and I think is actually very welcome and very important, and perhaps could be one of the most impactful longer-term projects of the new white paper, which is to have this register of regulators and try to have a central spot where all sorts of regulation comes in. I hope that's, it's kind of hard to tell from what they've said so far, but I hope that's the primary legislation, the secondary legislation, the codes of conduct, the guidance, the blog posts even that sometimes will have some kind of regulatory implication, that at least if you bring that all to one place, it will be much easier to analyze it. And I think part of the reason why actually we potentially don't have as much analysis of regulation in the UK is that it's very hard to track and analyze it. You know, yeah. There's George Mason University does this great project where they count up regulation and regulatory burdens. And I'm talking about this at one point, it was pretty much impossible for them to do it in the UK context because there was no similar depository that they could base their analysis on. And you've got to think about the implications for that are huge, even just the rule of law implications of not having a clear sense of what regulations and rules any business has to follow.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of instructive to think what we did and what I put the poor researchers through for that Centre for Policy Studies project. I think we looked at about 3,800 regulatory impact assessments published over a 10-year period. And there's a lot of duplication in there, so you had to, you know, get rid of the pointless ones. But these were... Now, to a certain extent, it was okay because they were all available on a government website. But the formatting changed. Mostly they were PDFs that you had to download one at a time. They weren't text searchable, so you had to, you know, properly read through them. They were littered with mistakes, so again, you couldn't just take everything you saw at face value. You know, compare that with a system where there was no reason why that couldn't have been an open database that was available for all researchers to download and for people to run, you know, kind of AI or machine learning experiments on. The George Mason thing, I think, is really interesting because, as I understand it, they take the US Federal Register, which is basically the compendium of all of the regulations that are in force, and then somehow they analyze that text for what they call restrictive clauses. So it's things where you must or shall or whatever.
Shall not.
Shall not, exactly. And so they use that to assess, is the regulatory burden falling? Is it rising? How is it developing over time? I think that's a really interesting project, and it's something that, as you say, if the government's able to deliver on the promise of what's in this white paper of a single register for all of the regulators and a very effective online portal for all of the different regulations and hopefully the impact assessments and options assessments and everything that would go along with that, now that could be a very good tool, and so that may shine some light and bring some transparency to the British regulatory state going forward. I mean, that's one of the good things in the government announcement this week, the greater degree of transparency. The other thing I just mentioned there, which was an options assessment, this is one of the sort of key post-Brexit shifts that the government is trying to engineer, which is that we've had a lot of scrutiny of regulation, certainly since 2010 and probably going back before that. But it has all come after the decision to regulate has been taken. And you know, that's kind of locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, because the crucial question is the regulation necessary? Is it proportionate to the risk that you're trying to address? Will it be effective? How much is it going to cost? Et cetera, et cetera. Now, those are all decisions that you or questions that you have to think through at the preliminary stage when you're considering, is a regulatory response to this question appropriate at all? And so this latest white paper is, you know, part of a chain of government announcements, which is about shining more light and paying more attention at that early phase in the regulatory process. So I think that's very good as well. And so they're also introducing a more serious growth duty where regulators will be forced to kind of analyze the impact that their work is having on economic growth and report on it on a regular basis and so on. Now, my concern with some of this stuff is that it's a little bit complicated. And the complexity gives regulators and other policymakers the opportunity to sort of game the system. Mm. And you do wonder, even though the intentions are great behind all of this, how much of a real-world effect will it have and how much attention will really be paid to it in Whitehall, particularly with a change of government, different attitudes towards regulation and so on, which may be coming down the track. But as I say, there are some really good things in what the government has come out with. So then I do think there are some negatives or some disappointments in the government's white paper this week as well. And so one of the big ones, and it's something I know we've talked about before, is that regulatory budgeting has kind of been dropped altogether.
Mm.
And there have been hints that, oh, it'll make a comeback in some form, But as far as I can tell, there's no real sign of that yet. And so, to be clear, regulatory budgeting is this thing that was introduced post-2010, and it took the form of the one-in, one-out rule, or the one-in, two-out rule, briefly, one-in, three-out, and then we had the business impact target. All variations on a theme, basically, where you would work out the net cost or benefit of various regulations. And if you were introducing a new one that imposed costs, you'd have to get rid of an equivalent amount of costs that were already in the system, or more so, depending on precisely how that rule was formulated. Now, it was an imperfect system. It was imperfect largely because so many different areas of regulation were excluded. And yeah, it was one of those things where if you looked at the things the government was counting, they appeared to be doing quite well.
If you buy their estimates about
and
costs.
If you buy their estimates, which are necessarily imprecise and often sort of finger in the air kind of estimates.
I mean, I would go further sometimes and say that they're extremely biased, if not. I mean, when I looked in you know, some of the policy work I was doing, like the online safety bill, there was basically the effort to try to assess what the cost of that would be was laughable, to the point where they were estimating the cost of a lawyer would be £36 an hour for a tech lawyer, and then add on top of that that it would only take 15 hours of work, and somehow that would be enough for the average kind of mid-sized company who might be impacted. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is just like so absurd to expect them not only to read 400 pieces of legislation, but now literally thousands and thousands of pages of guidance, figure out how it impacts their product and how the product might need to, like, it is mind-boggling, the underestimation in that case, let alone a lot of others.
Yeah. I mean, I've absolutely no doubt, having read through enough of these things, that you're right. And, you know, you hear anecdotally from secretaries of state who say they've never even looked at a regulatory impact assessment. You hear from people actually sometimes who've been responsible for compiling them, and, you know, they're arriving at a predetermined answer.
Yes.
Or they're just giving some kind of default small figure that they use when the costs and benefits are unclear. Nevertheless, I think that you can say this may not have been perfect, but it was better than nothing, because this was part of the CPS research as well. We looked not just at the regulations that were in scope for the regulatory budget, but also the ones that were excluded. And so we compared how the government said they did based on the regulations that they were counting versus how they did on if you include everything else. And I mean, perhaps predictably, for most of the 2010s, the government was doing pretty well on the stuff that counted for the targets. They'd set the target, they'd made a political commitment, and
what did
so they were
include,
committed to.
Though, let's...
Oh, well, I mean, all sorts of things weren't included. So minimum wage wasn't included, for example. Anything coming from the EU or international bodies was not included. I mean, in a way, you can see why, because it was out of their immediate control. But I would say that's all the more reason to include it, because if you want the regulatory burden to fall, then you should try and offset the stuff that's
also
coming
been
from overseas.
A lot of not including of environmental regulations, of fire safety. This classic example here of every property above a certain number of stories in two staircases.
Yep.
Whether or not that would have a huge
anything
cost.
Related to the Treasury was pretty much ruled out. It was a moving target.
Yeah.
Exactly. And what you find, perhaps obviously, is the regulatory burden, self-measured as it was, grew a lot faster when the government wasn't keeping track of it than where they were and where they'd set that binding political target. And so this is what makes me worry about ditching regulatory budgeting altogether. It's not that it was a great system that was pure, like, intellectual logic, but the fact that it did create a semi-binding constraint, and that's now been removed. It,
kind of institutional incentive, I suppose.
Exactly. And this is all about institutions and incentives, in my view. And the fact is, at the moment, we have institutions and incentives which are designed to produce ever more regulation. And the better regulation frameworks that the government comes up with are attempts to offset that and try and, you know, create some countervailing balance.
Some very weak kind of balance. I mean, it seems that the broader picture is one where the government's latest white paper, generally good, although in a long list of not too dissimilar proposals that haven't necessarily achieved that much in the scheme of things. You have this constant conservative rhetoric about the need to cut back the state or cut back red tape that hurts business. You have this, I suppose, myth in the Twitter sphere that has actually happened, that, you know, the Tories have massively deregulated and somehow the state has been withdrawn. And of course, any assessment, including your own assessment of regulatory burden, shows that it's massively increased. I suppose the next question there then is, what are you meant to do about this?
Mm.
So is it bringing back regulatory budgets and one in, two out rules? Is it removing those exemptions altogether? Is it sunsetting of it is something to talk about. In fact, I think it's there's some discussion in the white paper about sunsetting. Yeah, this idea that all regulations have an end date by default and should only be continued if they are shown to be necessary.
Yeah, so I think all of those things would be good and helpful. And what I talked a lot about in the CPS paper, and I keep saying it was co-authored with Rob Colville, by the way, so I don't want to take full credit for this. Both of our names are on it.
Rob will not be very happy.
All blame. We can share the blame as well, right? A lot of that report, and explicitly it says, we're talking a lot about structures here.
Mm.
And I think that those structural solutions are extremely helpful. Now, they might seem a little bit dry and boring. They might not actually seem that obviously free market. And, I totally accept that. But they are ways to try and offset the institutional incentives that exist. So things like having mandatory sunset clauses where, and I think you really need to reverse the burden of proof here, a regulation will expire X number of years after it's implemented unless a conscious decision is made to renew it. Because a lot of regulation, it may be good, may be bad, who cares? It's a political decision, comes onto the statute books. All of those political incentives might have dropped away 5 years later. Maybe nobody cares anymore. But as things stand, these rules and regulations just hang around forever. And it's not worth the conscious decision to go back and liberalise. If you make liberalisation the default, and you can always opt out of it, by the way, but if you make it the default, I think that changes the dynamics here quite significantly. We've talked about regulatory budgeting. I won't go over that again. One of the things that I think is maybe missing from the government's approach at the moment, and was in that paper for the CPS, was the idea that someone has to be in charge and responsible for the regulatory state. In the way that the Chancellor is responsible ultimately for fiscal policy, and no tax or spending decision is going to get through government without the Chancellor effectively putting his stamp of approval on it, or her stamp of approval. And that, again, it's not perfect. There are lots of things that the Treasury taxes or spends money on that we wouldn't like and approve of, but it's clearly better than not having that constraint. And I think we need something similar in regulation, where there is a senior government figure who sort of stakes their career on delivering regulatory liberalisation. And any decision to regulate across the economy the government is taking has to go through them, and they have to have the chance to say, I'm looking at the case you're making, and I just don't think it's good enough. No, we're not doing this. Same way the Chancellor would on a spending thing. And I think it's also important that whoever has that responsibility within government doesn't also have regulatory responsibilities of their own.
Yeah.
And that is one of the issues that we face at the moment. And I'm not blaming any of the people concerned for it. This is just the architecture of Whitehall. But the business department has to be the deregulatory department while also having quite significant regulatory responsibilities of its own. And there's kind of an issue there. So there are these structural approaches you can take, and I think they can be helpful. And I think
so,
we can make them
what you're saying
more effective.
We need to create a department for deregulation, another government department.
It does sound worryingly like that, and I kind of hate that whole mindset. But structural changes, I think, can be important, can be helpful, but it's not enough. That's sort of the first thing that we have to do. But I do think we need to have a more fundamental change of mindset about regulation. And that's kind of hard to engineer. This is a sort of more long-term cultural, policy, economic thinking shift that we need to see. And you know what? Actually, we can go back to your introduction when you talked about the government saying that because of the new smarter regulation stuff they're bringing in, there'll be no regulation unless it's absolutely necessary. Now, an approach that said there will be no regulation unless it's absolutely necessary, and also, by the way, that we'll look at the body of existing regulation and decide whether it's absolutely necessary or not, and if it isn't, get rid of it, that would be absolutely fantastic. And so I was quite excited when I saw that quote. It's not everything it appears to be. So in fact, the government has come up with 10 principles for smarter regulation.
Mm.
And I won't run through them, not least because I can't remember every single one off the top of my head right now. But they're good principles. They're sound principles. And if regulation was made in accordance with those principles, it would be better, lighter touch than it is at the moment. But what the government's actually said is, if we stick to these principles, then that means there won't be regulation unless it's absolutely necessary. But these are not quite the same things, are they? And I wonder, would the online safety bill have passed those 10 principles? I think it's a pretty safe bet because of political incentives that it would have done.
Yeah, it seems
there's no way it's absolutely necessary. Second staircases rule, all the digital competition stuff, a lot of the regulation of consumer freedoms around eating and drinking and smoking and vaping that we talk about, definitely not absolutely necessary.
I was about to say that the intrinsic problem here, of course, is not the institutional framework, but just the fact that philosophically, the advocates of every one of these pieces of regulations would indeed say they're absolutely necessary. Mm. And they wouldn't do the proper, I suppose, cost-benefit analysis in terms of what this is actually going to achieve in terms of its benefits. And does that justify the cost? Mm. I suppose that kind of leads me to a final question here, which is in some ways the institutional frameworks downstream from the culture that we've now in this kind of broader cultural framework, both within government itself, where all the incentives are to regulate, but you could even argue within the broader population, where there is just a sense that people want more control of things, that they want government to intervene to fix problems, that they do see the state as a solution to a lot of things, and there's not that necessarily much faith in market-based solutions. I mean, at the same time, people don't have that much satisfaction in government, so it's a bit of a potential double thing going on there. But is the problem with regulation, I suppose, in some senses, far broader and to be slightly pessimistic, far deeper than fixing some institutional framework issues?
Yes. I mean, clearly it is. And a lot of this is wrapped up in both just our general conception of what government's for and what its appropriate boundaries are. And you're right, increasingly, and it probably undergoes a step change with every sort of crisis, financial crisis, pandemic, etc. People want the government to intervene to correct whatever's gone wrong. Those responses tend to be regulatory in the long run, and they tend to hang around even if they've been proved not to have been that effective, or they wouldn't have prevented that crisis, and they're probably inappropriate to stopping future ones as well. But you get that sort of ratchet effect. So yeah, there is a general expectation of government intervention to solve problems, and that gives rise to this real regulatory impetus. I think there's probably also a deeper cultural thing going on, which is just changing attitudes towards risk.
Mm.
And you kind of wonder whether the incredible advances of the Industrial Revolution could possibly have happened with modern attitudes towards risk. And then by extension, what do our modern attitudes to risk kind of imply for things like artificial intelligence, or potentially, radical advances in life sciences and so on? How much are we holding back progress because we've become more risk averse? And I don't know where the risk aversion comes from necessarily. It might just be instinctive deep within us. It may be tied in with society aging. It may just be that because we're wealthier, we have a lot more to lose than previous generations. And so maybe in some sense, then it's a good thing, or at least it's natural and not a negative. But there is, of course, a downside. And I think if risk tolerances continue to shrink effectively, and if we want the state to protect us more and more, and, we often talk about the precautionary approach to regulation, that, there are different approaches. There's one approach which you could say is harm-based to regulation, which is we see harm happening. We think we're going to have to prevent that. We're going to have to come up with responses which deal with the harm. Okay, kind of makes sense. And then there's a precautionary approach, which is to say, we need people to prove that this product or this process or whatever isn't risky, that there isn't going to be any future harm from it before we allow it to happen and proceed. And I know that I'm oversimplifying here.
Well, I mean, in that context, you can't do anything, right? That's an intrinsic problem.
So we're not there, but maybe we lean more in that direction. We're more inclined to kind of head off innovation and progress because of fear of risk. I think that's a dangerous thing for our dynamism and our prosperity as a society.
Well, hopefully the enemies of progress do not win out in the end, and hopefully better ideas to the culture of risk and regulation ultimately are successful. Thank you so much, Tom Clockerty, the IEA's Executive Director, for joining the IEA podcast today. If you are enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe in your chosen podcast provider. And if you'd like to follow the IEA's work, just visit iea.org.uk.